From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell, and it probably used to be said to host a late night network TV show, you need a suit and tie and a consistent band leader. My guest, Seth Meyers, has proven that there's no truth to that stuff whatsoever. He's now into almost a decade of hosting late night with, wait, let me see who's the host of that. Oh, yes, Seth Meyers. Seth, good to have you back. Thank you for doing this, sir.
It's great to be here, Elvis. Thank you for having me.
And I've got to say, I mean, it's one of the things I think about post-pandemic. I mean, besides showing off your extremely voluminous collection of plaid shirts, that the idea of flipping that traditional its head and not wearing a suit to host a late night show really does something for the vibe, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And, you know, I never would have gotten there without the assist from the pandemic. But there was something about, as we went through that chapter of the show and doing it in the sort of places you're not supposed to do a talk show, like an attic in your in-law's house, and realizing that everybody, you know, wasn't just that we were stuck at home, everybody else was stuck at home who was watching us as well. So the show, by necessity, became more casual. And then when everybody came back and we started having audiences again, you know, none of them, Elvis, I don't want to call them out, you know, by name, but none of them ever wear suits to my show. You know, I said this before, but I always feel like when I put on a suit, even when I did Weekend Update, that I feel like a middle schooler in a production of Death of a Salesman, like that nobody actually believes I wear a suit. And so it just felt like a level of artifice that maybe we wouldn't rush back to. I will admit that I thought maybe we would be doing it again by now, but we're really happy with the casual feel of the show.
It's funny because I think there's something in your posture that's very different. It feels weirdly like the show that you kind of always wanted it to be.
Yes, I think that is very much the case. It should be noted, without knowing it was the show I wanted it to be. And I had every opportunity when I was handed the keys to this in 2014, I could have said, I want to do sweaters and button-up shirts, and maybe the network would have gone along with it. So it was a journey that I had to kind of land on it through, you know, what we were living through, what we were all living through. But it does feel comfortable. And, you know, the other thing, which took me about 8 years of doing this show to realize, and especially coming from SNL, SNL is not a comfortable show. And I don't think people who watch it at home want to ever feel like the cast and the writers are laid back and comfortable. It's Saturday night. It's dangerous. They want people to be on edge a little bit. Whereas when you're doing a show that airs at 12:37 on a Tuesday night, I think people are watching it with a different vibe, and it doesn't hurt to perform it with a different vibe.
One of my favorite segments, and we've actually talked about this before, is day drinking, which has always had that kind of casual ambience to it. It's also one of the first times that we got to see you sort of like nose to nose with somebody. And this is almost felt like a rehearsal for what the show became during the pandemic. Do you strip away all the sort of the trappings of what a quote unquote late night show is supposed to be? There have been iterations of this show, but rather than doing an ironic version of a late night talk show, we should remember that the first few months of late night, every once in a while, Letterman would show up wearing just a sweater and make fun of himself for wearing a cardigan. It just feels like you don't have to do that anymore because the talk show isn't the institution that it used to be.
It does still feel like an institution, but it was almost like we needed to be reminded, hey, the way this institution works, especially the 12:30 late night institution, is you can do whatever you want. Like, this is the whole point of having a second one on after The Tonight Show, is not to try to make a carbon copy of what's happening an hour earlier, but rather take the sort of leaps that you might not be able to do if you had the different time slot. And so, you know, again, like I said, circumstances sort of nudged us toward being a little bit more creative, but we're very happy with where we ended up now.
Well, I guess I have to say, too, because I just found myself thinking about what the show was like those first few months when you came back to the studio without an audience. Had you been doing that with a suit without an audience, I think it would have really added to that sort of level of anxiety that you're talking about that we feel with SNL, because part of that is that we want to see what's going to happen that's unpredictable. And for you, it's got to be about you making both the audience and the guests comfortable.
And, you know, there was also, especially when we first came back, it was about making the crew comfortable. I mean, they were the only other people there. And so that was a really fun thing because, I don't know, I feel like by watching our show right now, you see what's in front of the scenes and behind the scenes at the same time. They're sort of working in parallel with each other. You know, the monologue joke writers are working just as hard to write great monologue jokes, but there's a great deal more comfort now to talk about how a joke went, to call out Wally, our cue card guy, if there's a typo on the cards, to just turn to the audience and talk about what conversation went into doing this joke today and how much better we thought it would go. And now I'm realizing, well, you know, the folly of rating that joke so highly. But it is constantly switching back and forth to, hey, we're not working any less hard. If anything, we're working harder on the show than ever before. But we have this whole second gear of, hey, you guys, because part of it was, I feel like we all lived together during the pandemic. You know, I was doing the show into an iPad, and all of a sudden it dawned on me that most people were watching it in the same way, alone, facing a screen. And weirdly, when you have a live audience, it's impossible not to focus on them first and foremost, even though they're, you know, 200 people and you have over a million who are watching it at home. And so the home audience should always have been the most important. And yet it took a pandemic to remember, you know what, those are the most loyal people. And I'm going to really make a show for them. And I'm going to make a show for the people who are here Wednesday. I'm going to assume they were also here Tuesday. And so we're going to call back something that we did earlier in the week. And that's going to be a reward for them. And it's just been a really nice thing to build in.
My guest, who clearly literally rolls up his sleeves to do Late Night with Seth Meyers, is Seth Meyers. It's The Treatment. As we're talking about this, and I'm just thinking structurally about what Late Night has been, you don't take to irony. I mean, clearly the Letterman iteration was all ironic, and Conan's was even more so. And then Fallon was a bit of those, both show busy and ironic. But yours is actually a way of sort of saying, this is the show we're doing. This is the show and the day we're doing it. To me, especially with Closer Look, the show feels like a series of journal entries, pandemic, in a way they never had before.
Yes, I think that is how we feel as well. And there's something really liberating about deciding that you're going to make as much of the show each day about that day, not allowing yourself to get too far ahead in the calendar. Some ways it's like an improv scene where every day you get a suggestion from the news as to what the show will be about. You know, to comment on your irony observation, I think that's really true. I think, you know, especially when we're doing Closer Look, we're trying to be really authentic. Now, don't get me wrong, we're also trying to be really silly and have a lot of jokes. But, you know, Sal Gentile, the head writer for Closer Look, he really writes it out. I don't know if a journal entry is the way he plans on doing it, but there's very much like a thesis statement, and we go about trying to prove the point that we're trying to make. And look, not everybody's going to agree with us, but we do try very hard to show our work every day as to how we reached the conclusion we reached.
I brought up day drinking because the phrase that comes to mind to me, and I was looking at my notes as prepping for this, is eye contact. Is you treating the show like you're actually talking to people rather than talking to a camera. And that, for me, feels like the difference between this Late Night and all the versions that had come before.
I felt nothing unique about this. I felt so alone at that time. And I felt so much of a connection doing that show alone, realizing that I was looking into an iPad camera lens, but it was, I felt this great peace and comfort knowing there were people watching it on the other end. And that was our biggest fear about having an audience back in the studio, is were we going to lose this really intimate, connected show? And it was a wonderful thing to realize that the people who are coming to see it now are the same people that were with us during, you know, that 2 years away.
What you have come to do with the show, so to say, well, I can try to step into the same idea of sort of making this like sort of post-ironic mockery of what this institution is, or I can assume that people are coming to me because it's me and I can make it something that has my fingerprints on it.
That was so much, you know, to harken back now almost 6 years, even just sitting down at the desk at the beginning, which was, you know, year three of the show, was that first step towards, hey, this is the kind of person I am. And I do think people want to see the best version of me. I've always said, Elvis, that I think if you don't want me at your birthday party, but I'm not a bad person to sit next to at a dinner party. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to, like, be the most fun person if we're going to go out to the club and yell things like we're going to live forever. But get me at a dinner party where I can make some asides to you about the menu. You've hit the jackpot.
You've always understood that you're a communicator. That's why I call it, say, you have a common sense aesthetic. And your best points are made that way you're talking about. You're really making contact with somebody rather than trying to throw a blanket over or a tarp over an entire football field.
Part of it, too, is just wanting people to know you're not crazy for thinking what's happening in the world is crazy right now. Sal and I have said that we like to think of A Closer Look as a segment written and performed by the formerly sane, which is, you know, we were also like you. We also had an expectation of what the norms in our society were. And we've been watching it happen. And it seems like half of the people in this country want to tell you, no, this is actually, you're wrong. This is normal. And so, you know, we're not really setting out to convince anybody that they're wrong. We're just more dead set on convincing people like us that they haven't lost their minds.
Let me do this. I'll ask you to explain for our listeners what the difference is between the monologue and Closer Look.
Well, the monologue is our head writer, Alex Bays, pulls together jokes from our talented monologue writers. I think we have 7 right now. Over the course of the day, they may be collectively 300 jokes that yield about 10 to 12. And sometimes people say, you should print the other 280. And trust me, you don't want to read them. It's very hard. It is very hard to write monologue jokes. You know, I did them for years on Weekend Update. And I have so much respect for monologue joke writers because it is a skill that I never picked up. So, you know, that's just jokes that live alone. There's no connective tissue between the two of them, other than the fact that they're next to each other in the running list. And other than the fact that I do it at the desk, and obviously we use keys, it's very Weekend Update style, and I don't need to tell anybody that. But it is the way late night shows have historically always started, which is here are jokes about today's news. Now, the difference between that and a closer look is, unlike the monologue, which is maybe 3 minutes long, a closer look is often 12 to 15 minutes long. It's by far the biggest chunk of our show. And that is a far more longer form piece of storytelling. The story being what happened in the news that day and what we think those events mean on a grander scale. The other thing that is wonderful about A Closer Look that we found over the years, and especially during the pandemic, is it's a wonderful jumping off place for wild tangents, terrible impressions, and flights of fancy.
Oh my God, yes. But also during Closer Look, one of the things I love you do, there's almost like a reset. Well, you look like 4 minutes and you'll like make an aside that becomes its own sort of like rabbit hole. Then you go back to the main thesis of the piece. It gone from being what people would have called in the early days of it a rant to this piece that has found its own spine, which is to say it's supple enough to sort of go where you want it to go. And again, this to me is all this proof that you recast Late Night into Late Night with Seth Meyers in the truest way possible.
Look, there are a lot of times that we're talking about things that make us really angry. And yet at the same time, I've seen the way I look when I'm really angry. I don't find it particularly endearing. You know, we try to let people know, look, obviously I think it's important. Obviously I'm upset about this. But even when the news is really bad, I think you go through your day and you still find things to laugh about. And oftentimes those things are silly. So we're just trying to jam all of that into the body of A Closer Look, because I think that's how people feel and think and act when they live in troubling times. Is sure, you know, for 5 minutes you might be so depressed about something you just read. But, you know, then whether it's friends or family or something you read or see, you still have the capacity to laugh in those moments. And so we're just trying to find that balance over the course of the body of A Closer Look, too. So it's not just, you know, a 12-minute slog through the news, which is what we are basically always trying to avoid.
I don't want to use the word focus, but there's more of a kind of a narrative line, I guess, or a straight line through it. And there became a point. And even before the pandemic, you just kind of went, well, if we just kind of break this up, just kind of a reset, and then step back into it, that becomes, again, like the show's strength to me, which is, say, conversational rather than presentational.
Well, yeah, if there's a catchphrase these days at A Closer Look, the line that probably appears the most is, "Where were we?" So I think that speaks to your observation, Elvis. And, you know, we also, like comedy writers, you know, when Sal and Baez and I are all working on it, you know, over the course of the day, you tend to write jokes on jokes on jokes. And then it does truly become, in the writing, you have to look back and say, wait, where are we? What was the moment that sent us down this path that I'm all of a sudden doing a Vince Vaughn impression? How did that happen based on today's news? And so, again, the authenticity is to actually write in the script, where were we? Because that is exactly what happened in the writing of it.
We'll take a break. Where are we? Oh, we're with my guest, the host of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Seth Meyers. See, that's where we are. It's the truth. We'll take a break. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I was just complimenting my guest, Seth Meyers, host of Late Night with Seth Meyers, but I'll save it for here. Because what I was going to say is, what's really great about this show is that you make it seem like you don't want the show to show any effort. I mean, you really don't want there to be any kind of sweat stains or sweaty upper lip. And the impressions, like what I love, because they often seem to sort of like possess you, and you just can't help doing them at a certain point. And that's the fun of it.
Well, it's so funny that comment about sweat stains and effort, which is, that is how I felt my entire time at SNL, especially in my early days when I was a struggling cast member who often was assigned impressions, say, you know, John Kerry. And I would walk around all day. I would record him and I would listen to him on my, you know, earphones all day long before I did him. And I'd just be so in my head about it. And now, again, I don't consider myself an impressionist. We do so many because there's no expectation that we think they're good. And so because of that, they just become a thing that is better than good, which is fun. As I do them, I'm always thinking, God, if I wish I'd known at SNL that you could just have fun doing impressions as opposed to trying to actually sound like a person. Nobody ever was going to believe I was John Kerry. I should have just had a good time.
I know it's going to sound like I'm kidding, but I'm not. Sort of like after Arsenio Hall, which is to say, when he came out the night of the LA Rebellion and tried to make a connect with the audience, I feel like the best of Late Night has been when the hosts are doing what you're talking about, which to acknowledge what's going on in our country and let us know how you're feeling about it without making a speech or a statement, but also letting us know how absurd it is. And you've had so much ammunition to do that. And again, I was just thinking about what Closer Look was when you started versus what it is now. But I feel like you've, and maybe this is just so you are really sort of seized on this chance, sort of say, and you were saying in the first half a bit, here's where we are in the world. Isn't this crazy?
That's very much what we're setting out to do. It's so cathartic for us to write it. And then it's so cathartic for me to perform it. The goal is to make it cathartic for people to watch. That is sort of the trade-off, or I should say the compact we're trying to have with the audience, which is, hey, let us do this thing that makes us feel good, and we really think it'll make you feel good too. Maybe not good, but better. We aim for better. But people always say, what is the hardest part of your job? And the hardest part of my job are the days that I have to go in, and there's something so horrifying that happened in the news that I don't feel like any of my improv training or my sketch writing training or SNL or stand-up, anything has helped prepare me for, which is, you know, there's a terrible shooting or there's some, you know, awful event. But at the same time, you realize, you know, the deal you've made with the audience is you've got to say something about it, because we didn't build a show where the goal was to make people forget about what was happening in the world. We built a show to make people feel better about what was happening in the world. And sometimes the only way to make people feel better, and it's what makes us feel better too, is just knowing there are people out there who feel the same way. And there are people out there who have empathy and have compassion. And I think if you can talk to them in the way that you wish they would talk to you, that's sometimes the best you can do.
I think that that's where the show, really where the rubber hits the road for the show. Because it also forces you, I think, to ask yourself how you really feel about this, to get past your initial reaction, your visceral reaction to the horrors that we've experienced as a country for the last decade. And to say, well, no, what do I really feel about this? And again, that's, again, one of the things we use as a stand-up as somebody who employs common sense, and but also can remind us of how absurd these extremes are in a way that isn't just standing upon a soapbox, as they used to say.
The effort is always made to work through our feelings about it and to approach it in a way that's not rooted in an oppressive pessimism. We were so worried going into the 2020 election, and don't get me wrong, I think we'll be worried in 2024 as well. I think it would have been a really hard show to do had Trump been reelected, because what would you even say coming out of it? You know, we had to address Buffalo, and then, you know, a week later, it's Uvalde, and, you know, I'm not saying it was any harder for us than anybody else to have to process those two things in such short succession, but especially with the second one, we really had to tell ourselves and try to put it in the writing, like, this is not a time to give up or to think all is lost, even though that feels like both the most reasonable and easiest path to take. But that's where you're lucky to have a really talented staff of people that you trust, and you can sit in a room and talk about it in the hours that lead up to the show and make sure that what you say is something you will be able to look back on and be proud of.
Clearly, again, and just thinking about Buffalo or the subsequent, gosh, I hate to say just subsequent shooting because there have been so many, but the fact that it's almost like we can get the sense that you, before you do the show, you're going to take this metaphorical walk around the block to say, okay, what am I really feeling here? And what is it that I can say that won't turn this into a town hall and to remind us that we're all in this together? But again, there's a part of you that is always sort of saying, isn't this crazy? That is almost so often the subtext when you're responding almost in real time to what's happening during the day on the show.
After one of those tragic events, I remember our first reaction was, God, there's nothing left we have to say about guns. And there was the primary in Georgia last night, and we think that's really important. So let's just talk about that. And I think everybody at home will appreciate that, you know, we don't have anything left to say. And then over the course of the next few hours, it dawned on us, no, we have to say something. We can't put our head in the sand just because we're exhausted by it. Because again, it's sort of the deal we made with the audience, and it's one that we're really happy that they've gone ahead or gone along with us on. And so kind of buckle up and do the best you can. But it is helpful to know that if you start from a place when people tune in of saying, hey, it was crazy, you guys, and we know, and you know, and now we're going to tell you some of the details about how crazy it was. And then maybe we can all sleep a little bit easier knowing that there are people out there in this world with us who agree that it's crazy.
My guest, who's being very considerate, is the host of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Seth Meyers, this is The Treatment. And as long as we're talking about history, I mean, I just find myself thinking as we were talking, and also about your relationship and your relationship to the history of the show and your relationship to SNL. It was great to see Letterman come on, and what a different person he is now, and but also his respect for the institution of Late Night, that show specifically, and what you've done with it. What did that feel like?
Well, the trip with talking to Letterman is knowing that the last thing he wants is for you to spend the time with him telling him how great he is, right? He would be miserable. So anyone who's ever watched him knows his favorite conversations are ones that are in the moment, ones that are genuine. And so you just have to tell yourself, even though you're sitting with not only a legend, but one of your own personal heroes and a guy who started this institution that now is your, you know, your full-time job. And so there's a lot going on in your head, and you have to quiet all of that down, you know, but at the same time, he's also David Letterman. He's no one's better at it than him. So when the interview starts, you realize you don't actually have to do that much. You just have to, you know, find the wavelength that this historically great conversationalist is on and then just enjoy the ride. I mean, don't get me wrong, when it was over, I couldn't have been happier, but mostly because I hadn't embarrassed myself.
Were you really thinking that? Because, again, when he came out, he was so thoughtful about what late night had been and what you had done with it. Kind of like the conversation we're having now. It's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on again and talk, because he had some, clearly some historical knowledge of what the show had been and what you were doing with it. And it wasn't just empty compliments, but sort of, and it was a conversation, as you said. It wasn't just him coming out and doing Letterman and thank you, good night, everybody. And I found myself really taken by that, because again, to me, it's what the show is at its best, which is eye contact.
It was really lovely. And, you know, for me, one of the most special moments was he gave a shout out to Amber Ruffin and Jenny Hagel, who'd been in the first part of the show
before yeah.
he came out. And I think for me, you know, for him to appreciate their talent as well, and to feel really proud of the kind of staff we have, that they can go out on a night like that where Letterman's there and there are probably more eyes on the show than a normal night and can execute at the top of their game. It was special. I mean, I think that maybe a fault of a lot of us who do the kind of thing that I do is we can't accept a compliment when it comes. I think Dave Letterman might be another person who, if you give him a compliment, would immediately start deflecting. But it is... I think that's an interview. When this is all said and done, you know, and whenever I hang it up here, that will be the first one I will go back and watch to remind myself that it was a show worth being proud about.
But I think it was also a show about where you both were at that moment. You can't watch that and not think about what the history of that show has been and about how little of that show up until your iteration of it had been about conversation. I always thought of it before you came on as, first and foremost, a comedy show that was there to sort of basically take on the discontents of what late night had been. I'm not sure how conscious it was at first for you, but certainly as time went on, it became a conscious way of saying, I'm going to sort of put, you know, literally roll up my sleeves and let people see what it is I'm trying to do.
It is that moment where you stop doing what you think belongs on a late night show and start doing the things you want to do on a late night show. And I've always been deeply frustrated by the fact that when Lorne gave me this job, he said, it'll take you 18 months to figure it out. And my ego was saying, I bet I'll do it in 6. And then it definitely took 18 months. And I thought, son of a bitch, Lorne was right again. Quick side story about how crazy the world is right now. I was last night on Closer Look, I got beeped for saying
I know, and the former attorney general did not.
Yeah, so just so you know, last night the former attorney general got to say on my show, but I wasn't allowed. We are through the looking glass, Elvis.
No better place than that to end it on. My guess is Seth Meyers. He is the host of the more than ever, the show belongs to him, Late Night with Seth Meyers. Thank you, Seth. Always great talking to you. Thanks so much for doing this.
Great talking to you, Elvis. Thank you.
That was the host of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Seth Meyers. Though sticking around, we'll hear my interview with our old friend and arguing partner, David Simon. He gave us The Wire, and now We Own This City on HBO. If you can't stay tuned, you can find that and many of the fights with David Simon and Seth Meyers, for that matter, and other interviews and past episodes at kcrw.com/thetreatment. And you can also hear the show wherever you get your podcasts. Stay tuned. There's more to come on The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, David Simon, was last here for his drama, The Deuce. But we know him, of course, as somebody who's taken an examining eye, we should say, towards institutional impunity. And there's no better place to find it than in his new drama for HBO, We Own This City, an adaptation of the book We Own This City, a true story of crime, cops, and corruption by Justin Fenton. David, it's always good to have you back. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We should say that We Own the City is a look at the corruption side, the Gun Trace Task Force. And I guess I just find myself thinking there's so often, especially these last few things you've done, these adaptations, they're kind of built around a character with an ambiguous reputation who can get things done, but your point of view about it depends on literally where you stand.
Listen, I think we've been chasing something for a long time, which is this business about a country that and a society that no longer really is engaged in recognizing its problems, much less solving any of them. We're extremely good at politics at this point. It's all we do is political rhetoric and ruthless banter and maneuver. but we're terrible at governing ourselves. Self-rule seems to have escaped the American experience at this point. You know, this isn't a matter of like find the bad apples and replace them with better apples. This is a world in which the policies are just are the disaster.
No, but I guess I was thinking so much about these figures, and we can definitely say that Wayne Jenkins, who's the center of all this, played so well by John Bernthal, is that person. And I always wanted to ask you, and this gives me the perfect opportunity to do that, if the idea of responding to the hero mythology, that kind of question that should be asked, and the repercussions of quote-unquote heroism are something that you find yourself drawn to. Because, again, so often, so much in the last 10 years, we've seen that surface in dramas that you've turned to.
I mean, clearly the police department valued this man. They exalted him. But the truth was, the endemic corruption of the drug war, the stealing, the setting guys up, the robbing, the putting drugs back on the street, it wasn't all Wayne. It was happening in a variety of plainclothes units that all sort of culminated in the Gun Trace Task Force in Baltimore. But ultimately, it was throughout the department. And systemically, a lot of these guys were valued beyond their actual merit because the metrics were screwed up, because they put guns and drugs on the table, which were regarded as the police department as some sort of victory. To follow your parallel, I mean, I think in some ways, you know, Generation Kill was, you know, watch these guys do maneuver warfare. Watch them do it really well. Watch their weapon systems be used to considerable effect. But to what purpose? You know, what's the policy? What are we trying to do? What are we trying to do in Iraq? What are we trying to do with the drug war? And I think in some respects, that goes to the part that I found the hardest about journalism when I was in journalism, which is the who, what, when, where, how. You know, any 14-year-old can do that stuff. What made journalism an adult profession, at least, you know, for me, was the why. You know, why are we doing this?
As often as not, the people who stride through the worlds that you are interested in dramatizing and bringing to the screen are figures who walk with a level of assurance. We see it in Wayne's swagger. I mean, even in the most dire situations, he never speeds up. He never talks faster. He never seems to get nervous. His hands are always in front of him. To me, this kind of felt like this almost apotheosis of the corruptive power of heroism, both for him, because it goes through his head so fast, but also for institutions looking for somebody who can get questions answered immediately and take decisive action.
To me, the main characters are sometimes just the main characters because you got to put the camera somewhere. Yes, the efficacy of a character within an institution is often is how well they're regarded and how well their mission is regarded. And that is their capital. That's what they trade off of. And Jenkins clearly had that in Baltimore. So did some of the other guys as well, operating independent of Jenkins, because they all weren't in the same unit until the end. If you talk about Show Me a Hero, for example, Nick Wasisco, the mayor, he's compromised from the very moment you see him. He comes in as a very cynical politician who's going to campaign against the housing mandates that are essential to Yonkers' future. They, you know, otherwise, they're going to be in contempt of court. He gets elected. Then he has his reckoning. So, I mean, I don't think you travel very far in that narrative before realizing there is no hero.
In the fourth episode, that to me really is this kind of climax in a way. We get to see Wayne at several points in his life. And at one point, just when we think he can't do anything uglier, he robs a stripper during a sex act.
Yeah. Well, he did. And, you know, and a little person stripper, a dwarf. Yeah, that happened. This is the part that's the least interesting to me. I'm not fighting you on the premise, because you're probably right in that if you're writing a narrative and there are actors, you know, you've got to create character arcs, and characters have to get from A to Z, or it's going to feel fairly unsatisfying to a viewer. But man, it's just not what I'm chasing. It's just sort of, those are just means to an end, or they're the train you have to negotiate to make the argument.
No, I guess I'm bringing this up just because we've had conversations before about the sway of literature and the hunger for narrative. That idea of what a hero is in the first place is looking for an easy way out. Just sort of seeing how that pendulum swings for Wayne. Again, it really does swing so wildly in that fourth episode,
right?
And kind of in the center of it is this thing that really sort of spells out the institution where they can't even impanel a jury of 12 Baltimore citizens right. because there's such a jaundiced view about the police department. So it's not, again, I'm not trying to say you creating a hero. I'm just saying that I'm just talking about appearances.
I understand. Yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying. And I think in some respects, maybe tearing down that notion, since that's the standard of so much narrative in our culture, is either job one or it's something that has to be, you know, addressed quickly for the other things to find purchase. Here's the real tell, I mean, in terms of how we structured this thing is, The Wire was saying end the drug war. This thing's saying end the drug war in capital letters with a period between every word. And in order to do that, in order not to have this be some anti-hero story of how low will Wayne Jenkins go and will the cops catch him? If we wanted to do that, if that was our primary mission, we would have just played this straight. We would have played it chronologically straight, just the rise and fall of Wayne Jenkins. And we would have been, I think, doing the Shield all over again. The reason we broke time, the reason we had so much reflection from the point at which these guys are in prison jumpsuits and having their proffer sessions, and the reason we went back and played Wayne Jenkins, not from the chronological moment of the investigation in 2015, but all the way back to his first day on the job in 2003, and we ran these separate storylines, you know, risking confusing the hell out of everybody, is because it was the way to get to the question of why. You know, why is this police work? Why is this what is heralded? Why was this guy made a sergeant? Why was this guy making his salary again in overtime without it being questioned? Why was this guy given the run of the city? And the answer is our metrics are profoundly screwed up. We believe in this drug prohibition that's given us 50 years of failure. And it's not only destroyed people and neighborhoods and families, it's destroyed police work. You know, the police work in my city has fallen apart. When I came on the job as a police reporter, the clearance rate was above 70%, you know, above the national average in Baltimore. That meant, you know, once it shook out at the courthouse, about 4 in 10 people who shot somebody or killed somebody in Baltimore went to prison. It's now under 40%, and it's probably 1 in 10 go to prison. And the difference there is profound, is that, you know, when I came on the job, we had 220, 230 murders a year. We now have 100,000 less people in Baltimore, 700 down to 600, under 600 now. And we have 350 murders a year, and we're the most violent place in America. And that's because they committed to the wrong things, to putting dope and guns on the table. They thought this was police work, and they were grossly mistaken.
For me, that telling moment in the midst of all of this tumult going on in that episode. And it's not just we're waiting to see if he's going to get caught, but again, just about how he functions and what, as you're saying, police work has come to mean and what the police have come to represent. And just both black and white jurors that they're trying to recruit.
Yeah.
The one character says, I wouldn't trust a Baltimore cop if he said he loved his mother.
Right. Well, it got to that point. I mean, you know, when I was in the homicide unit to write my first book, it was 1988. So that is, you know, that's a generation and a half, maybe two generations of policing ago. And the homicide detectives that I was following, they were complaining then that the alienation between the police department and people on the street was such that the phone wasn't ringing anymore with tips on shootings. You know, when Tater would shoot Pee-wee, somebody would get on the phone and drop a dime, even anonymously, and tell you who the shooter was and start you on the way to a case. And they were complaining then in 1988 that the phone didn't ring the way it used to. Well, the phone doesn't ring at all now. Because as you saw in the second episode, the moment that Wayne came on the job in 2003, we had a mayor who was trying to be governor, and he had promised to get the murder rate down. And he thought the way to do it was to lock up 100,000 people a year in a city of 600,000 people. He thought, if I just lock up everybody for loitering, for being on the street, for basically being a Baltimorean on their front steps, whatever, if I get them off the street, they can't shoot each other and the murder rate will go down by that artifice. So everyone went to the city jail, whether or not the charges held or not. They, you know, and I mean, if you think I'm making this up, the ACLU sued and basically settled with the city to make them stop. It actually happened. More than 100,000 people in a year were in handcuffs. That's everybody's brother, everybody's cousin, everybody's son, everybody's father. Try to make a jury pool out of that. Try to get cooperation of a city after you've done that.
Again, for me, that's maybe one of the most chilling moments I've seen in anything that you've done. Just then that echoes throughout that entire episode and the rest of the series, I would guess.
we've reached a terminus for the drug war. I mean, I say that, and they'll find a new basement to dig tomorrow. But, you know, if you'd have said to me at the end of The Wire, which, you know, we wrote the last words of The Wire 15 years ago, if you'd have said to me, you're going to have whole units that go so bad that they're going to be breaking into city drugstores and stealing the oxy and selling it to dealers in other cities, if you'd have told me that, I'd have said, nah, too much. You know, too much. Go back to the writer's room. Come up with something plausible. The cops would be brutalizing people in an alley, and, you know, certainly in a pre-smartphone era, they would lie about it and get away with it. Sure. But the idea of robbing regular citizens of their money, not people you're arresting, but regular citizens, you know, in a car stop, just pocketing the money, or robbing a drug dealer and taking the drugs and reselling the drugs on the street, that's a level of cynicism and debauchery that, hey, you know, I've been looking at this stuff a long time, but I'm impressed. You've now got my attention.
It's the truth. My guest, who I'm always a little overexcited to talk to, that's why I'm talking over him a little bit today, is David Simon. His newest project for HBO is an adaptation of the Justin Fenton book, We Own This City. And this constant question you're asking, and basically everything you've done, which is, where does justice lie in the midst of institutions that try to really quantify it? And that's what it's become in this situation here. A quantification of arrests and numbers lead to quote unquote justice.
Why are you arresting somebody is the question that nobody's asking in a really smart philosophical way anymore in this country. To make a city safer, you have to respond to the crimes that are hurting other people. Crimes against people, murder, rape, robbery, assault, burglary. These are the crimes that make a city untenable. In order to solve one of those in a very basic way, you need skill sets that are taught, you know, taught one generation or the next in a healthy police department. You need to know how to use and not be used by an informant. You need to know how to testify in court without perjuring yourself. You need to know how to canvass properly. You need to know how to use the databases that are available to you as a cop in terms of the computer tech of it. You need to write a proper and coherent search and seizure warrant that'll hold up in court. You need to know the Fourth Amendment. There's so much that you need to do in order to be a functional, professional police officer. What you need to know to fight the drug war is you drive your car up to a corner, you screech on the brakes, you know, you jack everybody against the wall, you give this guy a ground stash that he's standing near, you find two vials in this guy's pocket, you know, maybe if you're lucky, you find a gun on the tire of the parked car, and you throw everybody in a wagon. And you don't even care whether it comes to court. It's all just stats. But for that, you'll get paid. You'll get paid overtime. You can sit down at evidence control, submitting this stuff. When the case does come to court, whether or not it's dismissed or not, you know, you show up there on your day shift after working night shift, and they give you 3 hours of overtime. And then when it's time to promote you, to promote somebody, to make them the sergeant, the lieutenant, you're the guy with 40, 50, 60 arrests a month. They think you're the worker. So the guy who actually figured out on his post who was robbing people with a handgun and arrested him, he's got one arrest. It goes into the police computer like a feather. He doesn't get paid a ton of overtime. He gets one case going to court. That guy doesn't get promoted. So the guy who's learned how to not do the police work that makes the city safer, he's now the lieutenant, the sergeant. He's training the next generation.
I just found myself in watching that first season of The Wire, which really holds up, by the way. At the base of it, it was about finding information.
Right.
That demanded contact with the community in that area. I mean, you may not trust anybody, but you still talk to them.
Right.
And the lack of conversation between the police department and the people in the streets, who basically just look like numbers to them. At no point does John Bernthal's character, or for that matter, Josh Charles' character, ever think about communicating with these people. And you were talking about Jamie Hector's character at one point where he sees collateral damage wrought by Nick, these people who were in an accident, one of whom dies. And at no point is there any real concern. And that, for me, almost feels like the turning point for his character.
I think he left the drug enforcement and plainclothes work disgusted. And that's why I think he sought the posting he finally had in homicide. You know, you're absolutely right. Information is the great, it's the fuel of good police work. Is who's talking to you and what can they tell you and how connected are they and how willing are they to give you the information you need to make cases and to get stuff to the courthouse.
I just found myself thinking too about how in The Wire, and again, looking at that first season, how you sort of build in almost novelistic terms, letting us get to know who everybody is just by the way information is being sort of disseminated about them, and then how the criminal class and the cops have to know each other and know the people around them to survive and to thrive. And without that really exchange of information, it's a whole different ecosystem. And I just wonder if that was one of the things that you found fascinating about this material, that it was a whole other way of, I hate to use the word accomplishment, but literally, at least at the very least, execution of police work.
The overlay that makes it particularly debilitating, because I live in Baltimore and I'm vested in the city's future, is so much damage is being done and there's no institutional response. You know, we can't solve the murders we need to solve. We have street robberies in places we didn't have street robberies before. We have churches being burglarized. The standards for making the city viable disappeared when we valued the drug arrest, or worse, or putting drugs and guns on the table. When these things became the metrics for success, the city was made vulnerable. Cities are always a little bit chaotic, and police work is never perfect, and some percentage of crimes are never going to get solved, even in a healthy environment. But it's a disturbing collapse in professional ethic that surrounds the scandal, so that even if the guys who weren't stealing, even the guys who were, you know, either afraid to steal or had conscience enough not to do it, the question is, could they do the other work? Or has that institutional memory of this is how you do this, has that leached out of our criminal justice system? And I think it has. I think 50 years of valuing this stuff and rewarding this stuff in terms of the drug war and in terms of drug prohibition and mass arrest, we're reaping the whirlwind now.
I guess one of the reasons I started off a conversation by talking about, for me, so often you're questioning a figure that seems effective, is that, you know, that's kind of the coin of the realm in police dramas. And so often police dramas, and your stuff exists again as a rebuttal to that, the idea that in those shows that justice flows equally everywhere. And for you, it's that justice flows down, or the quote unquote institutional justice, and trickles upwards. And that's why with all this stuff happening, it takes so long to build this case against the Gun Trace Task Force, because it's everywhere. And the real interest is finally just managing those numbers. In addition to me thinking that The Wire is going to change the way police shows were done, that it really hasn't, that myth still exists.
From my first moments as a police reporter for the Baltimore Sun, I never believed that justice meted out equally anywhere. I was very aware that a murder in some zip codes would get an appropriate amount of police attention because of the tax base or the tourist fears or whatever. You know, you kill somebody in the Inner Harbor, the police department's going to react and react strongly. That's probably still the case to some extent. There are red balls. You know, if a drug dealer falls in West Baltimore and there's no one there to hear him, does he make a sound? And that's always been the case. And that's the case in every city. In the industrial assembly line that is death investigation or criminal investigation, the have-nots, they don't get the finely built cases. They don't get that kind of casework.
I wondered if some part of you thought that police drama couldn't continue the way it was going just because it was still, again, following that myth of the effective cop clearing cases and taking care of the streets. Some part of you must have thought, well, they can't keep doing this. They can't keep making these shows.
Well, I actually wrote a memo when I was proposing The Wire to HBO. I said, look, if you do this, if you go into the network's wheelhouse of the cop show, and instead of making a show of will they catch the bad guy, you make a show that says, what is a bad guy? How did we make them a bad guy? Who are the good guys? What is the mission? What are they really trying to do? What is this war, this overlay of drug prohibition doing? If you ask all these questions, it's so that at the end, people don't feel, even if you lock up somebody at the end of a season, somebody takes a charge, you don't feel as if the world is getting any better, then you've done something subversive and something very true, I thought. And I actually wrote a memo to that extent. It's floating around on the internet somewhere. Somebody eventually leaked it. That's actually in there. And I basically said, you have stolen one back from the networks. But even in my hubris, I did not claim that the networks would stop programming that because it's just their bread and butter. You know, it's like a Western, except it's the inner city and the thin blue line is all that stands between us and chaos. I didn't buy my own rhetoric enough to believe that they would stop putting straight cop shows on TV. But I did think that a certain percentage of people would see those straight cop shows and go, nah, there's something missing.
Well, I don't know, because, I mean, we look at what the world is now and what we've seen in the past few years, especially with the advent of technology that allows us to see what's going on in some of these awful, if you quote unquote arrests, but that these cop shows are still thriving is a big question to me.
Listen, some things are going to get better. One of the things that's going to get better is because of the advent of smartphones, which has been a revolution. I can tell you, you know, as somebody who was a police reporter in the era before smartphones, it really came down to the cop's word against the arrestee, and the cop always won. There had to be a street full of unimpeachable witnesses for that case to get anywhere near an indictment of a police officer. And now we're seeing first-generation evidence of police malfeasance and police violence and unnecessary police violence. And that's a good thing. And that's eventually, you know, with some residual delay, because nobody learns anything right away, you're going to see police be a little less flagrant in terms of their use of violence against their arrestees, because they're going to have the consciousness that everywhere there is a camera pointed at them. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. But what happens in the dark, off the street, in a raid, at the point of arrest, when a mattress is turned over, when drugs are recovered, that's a function of vice enforcement that has always been subject to corruption.
We're out of time. David, it's always so great talking to you. Thank you for doing this. My guest is David Simon, whose newest project for HBO is the adaptation of the book We Own This City.
Thank you.
That was our old friend David Simon, writer and producer of the HBO series We Own This City. Of course, you know him from The Wire. Up next is Emily Bodie of the fashion line Bodie with The Treat. Is it about style? Stay tuned and hear. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Welcome back. Award-winning designer Emily Bodie of the line Bodie gives The Treat a stylish and familial frame.
Hi, this is Emily Adams Bodie Ajla of the menswear brand Bodie, and this is The Treat. So my mother saved a lot of her clothing from when she was in her 20s. And when she was in her 20s, she traveled with two of her best friends from high school. And I have been lucky enough to inherit a couple of sweaters of hers that were hand-knit. Recently, my mom has sent me scanned slides of her high school friends and her traveling with maybe their boyfriends at the time. And they sent me slides of them buying the sweaters in the shops in like 1976. So I have the sweaters that my mom actually bought. And then I have the slides of all the different colorway options that they were offering on their travels. And it is so incredibly amazing to me that she saved them. And I have reproduced them in my collection out of hand-dyed, you know, hand-knit merino wool. And that's something that is forever inspirational to me. So I have sweaters that actually even my grandmother wore, and I have photos of her wearing them at like garden parties, you know, in New England. And then I also have some really beautiful Peruvian sweaters that my mother's college boyfriend gave her, and she saved them. You know, I have them and I wear them, and they inspire me so much in my line. I show collections twice a year. We have our one-of-a-kind program that is made from antique, vintage, and deadstock materials. So each individual textile can make, you know, up to usually one piece of clothing. And then my historical reproductions are usually inspired by domestic cloth and clothing that was really important to the narrative or the person that the collection revolves around. So the collections have to do with my relationship with somebody specific. And then, you know, if they have even, you know, a sweater from childhood, I look at those or their mittens or things like that, and then I can reproduce them into clothing. My favorite response is when people say, oh, that reminds me of, you know, a sweater that my grandfather had, and you know what my grandfather did? He did this, and, you know, and then he lived here, and people get into this, you know, this tumbling state of memory. And I, you know, I want to encourage people to remember their family histories and their past and really feel something when they see our clothes and when they try them on, and to have that true emotional response, you know, when they feel the textile, the weight of the textile, and when they put it on their body.
That was fashion designer Emily Bode of the line Bode. The treatment is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney, who works very hard. It's mixed by Kenny Gilchrist, who works just as hard. We had help this week from Lara Kandarajan. Next up, you'll love it, music with Ann Litt. You know me. To better days, everybody. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.